Welcome to a University of Bath IPR Policy Podcast.
Okay, I think we'll make a start, folks. Welcome to this evening's event. My name's Nick Pearce. I'm the Director of the Institute for Policy Research here at the University of Bath. And I'm delighted this evening that to welcome you to this talk by Professor Sir Geoff Mulgan. Geoff is going to talk about his new book, When Science Meets Power. And Geoff is incredibly well qualified to talk about both sides of that meeting. He's currently professor in science and technology engineering and public policy at the University College London, but previously chief executive at NESTA, the National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts. Before that, also chief executive at the Young Foundation, and then where I met him, which was when he was head of the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit in No. 10 Downing Street, previously the Performance Innovation Unit. So Geoff has had an incredibly interesting and varied and very relevant career to talking about this question of science and power. So I'm not going to say much more. I'll let Geoff talk. We'll have a chance for Q&A, debate, discussion at the end. Geoff said he's very happy to be aggressively challenged. We're very into discussion, so please don't hold back with your questions at the end. And just a little bit of housekeeping, which is that we don't expect there to be a fire alarm in the next hour. If there is, we will have to leave by the exits there and down to assemble outside the building on the green in front. So that's just a bit of housekeeping. But no more from me. Geoff, over to you. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Nick. I've been an admirer of Nick's work for many years, and we are actually collaborating on something at this very moment. And it's very nice to be in Bath on a rainy Tuesday with spring fighting to get through somewhere. And I'm going to share with you some ideas, some theories, some examples, some facts even. But I hope we can then have, as Nick said, an interchange. I'm not totally wedded to everything I'm going to say. And I hope this will prompt discussion. And I've sort of fallen into this topic a little bit by mistake. So I thought I'd just start with this. What proportion of the British public now think the pandemic was a hoax? Do you know by any chance? In fact, does anyone in this room believe the pandemic was a hoax? Maybe not in a university, no one would dare. So it's about a third of the public now think this. And I've in the last year met many of my neighbours, right, who definitely believe that. And 2 years ago were rabidly anti-vax. Some of these dynamics got me interested in what's happening to science and what's happening to the politics of science. And as Nick said, I've had a number of roles, mainly as a bureaucrat. I've worked in city government, national government, and quite a bit in the European Commission. I ran NESTA. I currently help run a thing called IPO. And in Europe, I'm part of the European Parliament's sort of science and technology assessment machinery, and just finishing in the next 2 weeks a project on whole of government innovation, where the exam question is really, if you are a national government, a Finland or Portugal or Slovakia, how do you get all of your ministries and agencies roughly aligned on something like net zero or AI? I'm not going to talk about that, but we might, if anyone wants to raise that, please do, because we're launching in mid-April. There. And luckily, Brussels still allows Brits to do a few things. We haven't been completely thrown out. So the question which I've sort of got interested in a way, is a broad one. What is, and ideally, what should be the relationship of science to power in all its forms? And how do we think about several slightly different but often overlapping problems? The rise of anti-science, sort of bad or dangerous science, which we should be scared of, and also undemocratic science. Is there a new kind of settlement needed and emergent? And I will argue for some of the elements of a rather different way of organizing the relationship of science to power. And that's where we can get some interesting disagreement. So my premise, my starting point, in some ways is very simple, which is that almost every decade, the proportion of topics which are high on the agenda of governments, prime ministers or presidents, which involve science, is steadily rising. Obviously, pandemics, but also climate change. They have to understand pretty complex science on climate. AI in the last year has completely spooked the governments of the world. And that's a topic I've been very involved in for about 10 years. But also issues like mental health. So not that many issues which governments have to deal with have no science at all, and quite a lot have a growing proportion of science. So, you know, what follows from that? Some of you may remember the halcyon days, exactly 4 years ago. Was it 4 years ago today, the first lockdown? I'm trying to remember. We've all blacked it out of our memory. Anyway, round about then, our great Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, said he would follow the science. And in a way, that sounded really simple. Yep, clearly science tells us there's this horrible pandemic, infection rates will go like that, hospitals will be overrun, so let's just follow the science. And I actually started writing, I wrote a small piece in March 2020 on why that was probably not very wise. And in a way, that was the prompt for writing the book, was trying to disentangle what was the problem with that approach. And one place I started was with a comment from Peter Gluckman, who was chief science advisor in New Zealand and also chaired the International Network of Government Science Advisors. And he, a few years ago, made this statement, which I won't read out, but in a way, it's the heart of the issue that so many issues now are simultaneously scientific and political, whether it's recreational drugs or family violence or aging or climate change and so on. So that's the kind of, that's the problem. How does politics deal with things which are simultaneously scientific and political? And in some ways, counter to what I showed about the beliefs about COVID being a hoax, there's actually pretty strong underlying faith in science according to some surveys. So this is an EU one. I don't know what the UK equivalents are now. 86% overall pretty positive about science and technology, positive about the effects of solar energy or vaccines or AI. We don't live in a world where everyone is a kind of Luddite, fearful of everything. But we have a structural problem. And this is really the heart of my book, which I call the science-politics paradox. That when a powerful new body of science comes along, which could be nuclear weapons, could be artificial intelligence, could be new synthetic biology methods, which can give us, you know, artificial milk or whatever, ultimately, the only way we have of guiding that direction of science and technology is through politics, through government. That is how we make collective decisions. But at the moment, the scientists are pretty highly trusted. This is a survey of 28 countries, as are teachers. Probably many of you in this room are teachers. You know, they're highly trusted. And this group at the bottom, civil servants, government ministers, politicians generally, generally pretty low trusted. So how on earth are these people going to be trusted to steer these people in the direction, the development of very powerful science and technology? That's the paradox. We've got no mechanisms other than these to guide these, but this lot are untrusted, and often with very good reason. And that's one of the good reasons. But in a way, that's the easy bit, is sort of the next president of the United States, you know, has a slightly distant relationship with science and the truth. That was his cure for COVID, in case you've forgotten. But he was reflecting something much bigger. This is an extraordinary chart from a year or two ago showing the culture wars around science. How back in the 70s, Democrats and Republicans were both, you know, moderately pro-science. And actually the Democrats have become very pro-science, but the Republicans have really turned sharply away, which is why Ron DeSantis at one point tried to outflank Trump by being even more anti-science than him, and why there is a sort of deep structural issue which is now being also repeated in some parts of Europe in terms of the politics of science. Now, that's one set of issues which in some ways are relatively, well, they're not easy, but they're the straightforward ones. The much more complex ones come, for me, were symbolized by Anthony Fauci's testimony to Congress. Have any of you seen the YouTube video of Fauci in Congress. So he was presented as the kind of hero. If Trump was the sort of stupid idiot villain, Fauci stood up for truth and science and facts and vaccines and so on. In this testimony to Congress, he talks about how he was being questioned about why the US NIH funded gain-of-function research in Wuhan. That's to say, research trying to see if you could make viruses much more dangerous. And he was put in a really difficult position because it seemed insane to the Congress people interviewing him that the US government had funded this. And he had then been part of what was essentially a cover-up of it, which is a long and complex story. But it definitely wasn't a happy moment in terms of the relationship of science to power. And Congress definitely thought something had gone badly wrong in its relationship with this apparent sort of paragon of scientific virtue. And this is, to my mind, an extraordinary diagram, which sort of sums up a bit of the problem for Fauci. This is a map of BSL-4 labs, which are the biosafety level 4 labs, which are the most dangerous biosafety labs, doing very dangerous research, people wearing hazmat suits and so on. There are lots of Hollywood films of them. And this is where some of them are. And the amazing thing is most of them are in big cities. But the people in those big cities are completely unaware this extremely dangerous research is happening on their doorstep. There are 69 of them worldwide, either in existence or in making. And again, to me, this is a symptom of something's gone slightly wrong with the relationship between science, democracy, communities, when these places are being put in Lyon, Hamburg, London, Stockholm, Rome, and so on, without the people around them knowing they're there. This, a few months ago, was another symptom of something badly wrong. Did any of you watch this? Our Prime Minister interviewing Elon Musk. I mean, in the old days, this would never have happened. A journalist might have interviewed Elon Musk, but a Prime Minister sort of almost humiliating himself in front of Elon Musk over artificial intelligence. Again, showed something had gone very, very badly wrong in the relationship because he was meant to be steering artificial intelligence. That's what government is meant to do, to help maximize the benefits, reduce the risks. And yet here he was, in a sense, becoming the deferential supplicant. And not far down the track, we have perhaps even more difficult issues than AI. There's lots of money going, probably including in Bath, into quantum. A whole series of commissions and reviews on quantum. No one really knows, someone in this room might, but whether quantum will at a stroke end all the encryption on our WhatsApp, our Gmails and so on, or whether it will be a wonderful source of new industries. It might be both, for all we know. And the question, how should we even have that conversation, is quite a difficult one, which nowhere in the world has yet worked out. How do we discuss not to, at a stroke, destroy all privacy, for example, just because it made for some wonderful maths? So that's where, in a sense, those are some of the problematics. And I'll just go very quickly then through my arguments. I'm being a bit slow here. So part of what I've written about in this book is an attempt at describing the history of how we got here. Part of that history is in some ways a straightforward history, just of states using engineering and science. I use various examples. One is, which I love, is Sichuan, where in the 3rd century BC, engineers had an amazing solution to flooding, which basically made Sichuan the richest province in China, the happiest, the most relaxed, and so on for 2,000 years. And this is one I was a bit involved in South Australia, where the premier was facing power outages and did a deal with Elon Musk again to build the world's largest battery so he wouldn't have to build a new power station, and it turned out to work providing backup. So this is in some ways straightforward use of science to solve a problem and enhance the prestige of the political leaders. Oppenheimer last year, you know, reminded us of how that was done at an incredible scale in the US in the Second World War. The nuclear program bigger than the entire auto industry at its peak, and alongside massive direction of the whole of industry, tank production, aeroplane production, and so on. This was probably the most impressive ever in history, mobilization of engineering for war. We're all used to the equivalents for the economy, Germany, Japan, Italy, France using science for the economy. And then the quite strange patterns, which I will just show because this isn't very widely known. In the 1950s, the US defense-related spending was over a third of all global R&D. Quite extraordinary figure. It's now about 3 to 4%. So there's been a complete, at this point, there was a perfect alignment of science and tech for war and science and tech for economic growth and Silicon Valley. Now we're in a very different position where business is much more in the lead. Amazon every year spends over 40 billion on R&D. UK public spending on R&D is about 14 billion or so. So different orders of magnitude and a much more multipolar world. And I also in the book write about how much science has been used by states for glory, which I think is underestimated as a motive, whether it's Concord or landing people on the moon or a few millennia ago building pyramids. And in the last half century, more and more governments have had to worry about a completely different pattern, which they weren't talking about a century ago, which essentially is risk. Nuclear weapons, pollution, climate change, toxicity of all kinds. And one of my great influences was the anthropologist Mary Douglas, who was at UCL, who did, I think, still some of the best analysis of why you can never have a science of risk, because risk is deeply cultural, but it's essential to understand the cultures of risk if you're going to deal with all the risks produced by science. So that's a very quick run through. A little bit of the theory then, which I argue, is that we're still in a way picking up the pieces from essentially a 17th century, from two bodies of theory which sat alongside each other. One was the theory of absolute sovereignty, which Hobbes and others argued and is still an article of faith for the British Parliament. It has total sovereignty. It can decide anything for anyone, which is kind of quite weird, but is repeatedly restated as a fundamental principle of the British system, that politics should reign over everything, family, science, religion. And at roughly the same time, the Royal Society was created with the wonderful slogan, Nullius in Verba. How many people in this room know what that means, incidentally? You don't learn Latin. No. It basically means don't believe anyone. Anyone's word for it, which is a wonderful slogan, but it says doubt, scepticism is at the heart of science. And in a way, they then crystallise this idea of the autonomy of science, why science should be not under the control of politicians, should decide its own funding, its own rules, and all the apparatus of peer review and funding, you know, in some ways dates back to that. That, in a way, is what we've been in various forms living with for a long time, but as I'll argue, I think is now anachronistic. And it's partly anachronism because of a slightly weird pattern, which I use Hegel to describe, who probably isn't read that much these days. I don't know how many people. But he has this wonderful little story, it's very famous, the dialectic of the master and the slave or the servant, which has also been made into a couple of films. It's a very simple idea that at first the master dominates the servant who goes and does all sorts of jobs for the master. But because the master is sort of sitting in his armchair watching Netflix and the servant is sort of doing stuff in the world, the servant actually becomes more and more powerful, more and more capable, and the master becomes more and more dependent on the servant, and the master doesn't even understand the things the servant is doing. So this dialectic is that at first it appears the master has all the power and the servant none, but it flips around. And I think that's partly what's happened in the relationship between science and government. And it's partly why Boris Johnson, flanked by these two scientists, said he was following the science, because compared to 100 years ago, they were sitting at the apex of huge systems of research and knowledge and academic journals and labs and millions of researchers, whereas he was kind of busking it. Politics hadn't really advanced much in its methods compared to 50 years ago or 100 years ago. And so he was definitely dependent on them. Although he was technically the master, he wasn't really. He didn't even know what questions to ask them, how to challenge them. And this became more and more apparent through the pandemic and has come out through the inquiry. And in the book, I argue that to make sense of this, you have to understand there are sort of three logics interacting all the time in this. A logic of politics, which is fluid, pragmatic, present-oriented. A logic of science, which is neutral, very long time horizon, sees knowledge as inherently good. And a third logic of bureaucracy, which turns things into rules and representations and process. And they are necessarily just different ways of seeing the world. It's not that one is better than the other, but they complement each other in systems. But those systems work well if there are people who are multilingual between the different logics and can make sense of them. And I spend a lot of time with people in all three, and most people in all three logics think are really quite contemptuous of the others. Many scientists are genuinely contemptuous of politicians. They think they're just really quite thick. They just don't understand stuff. Politicians often think the scientists are completely unrealistic, haven't a clue about, you know, the public, and then the bureaucrats tend to see both of them as silly in different ways. And so part of the, and I'll go very quickly through this, a lot of the book is arguing actually the new settlements we need will all in some ways be hybrids of these different logics, integrating them in different ways from the traditional model. And very briefly, I hope I'll make that clear. So one of the easier ways is what I call the sort of scientization of politics, just bringing scientific method into the everyday life of government. That happens quite a lot with things like What Works centres or, you know, bodies like NICE, you know, analysing the cost effectiveness of different treatments. Probably most people in this room would think that's generally a good thing. There's beyond that the extension of experimental method into government. Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee won the Nobel Prize for advocating this in development. There are lots of different variants around the place of using this pure scientific method, and instead of doing something with a law at the level of a nation, you try things out small scale and fast with control groups before you go more general. There's then other things which are live, which I think are also a semi-scientization of politics. I've been working over the last year with various partners on using generative AI large language models for evidence synthesis. And if you're interested, we published a review of these a few months ago. Fairly soon, and these are not like ChatGPT trained on the whole internet, they are trained on validated research. They're beginning to get us to a position where if you are a policymaker in, I don't know, Bath's council wanting to think about some problem on, I don't know, water management, you can really quickly get fairly good syntheses of global knowledge. You can interrogate it with detailed questions. And that just brings the scientific method of research into everyday government. I argue a lot of the model of science advice we have, which Patrick Vallance was an exemplar of, I don't think works anymore in all sorts of ways. He, in some ways, embodied the idea the role of scientists was just to advise, and the politicians made the decisions. But in reality, he was making decisions, but wasn't then accountable for those decisions. So I think we need, on the one hand, a different way of organizing science advice, which isn't just an individual put into a department, but actually roles whose job is much more about orchestrating the full panoply of collective intelligence, but also that they actually have to have executive roles and accountability for decisions. They have to become hybrids in a way. I argue that we need to look at democracy too. One of the strange things of the traditions of science policy is it's mainly been governed by three sets of interests. One is the scientists themselves, the Royal Society ideal of autonomy. The second is state interest, hence the huge traditional investment in the military and surveillance, and the third being business. But actually the public has very rarely had much of a say about what the priorities of science should be. And this was a recent poll in the UK done by CAIS, the end of last year, I think it was. Only 9% of the British public think they benefit a lot from government investment in R&D. Younger groups less. Most people just don't know what's happening around them. And our science world has kind of played an insider game, very successfully in the last 10 or 15 years, but possibly not noticing there's a slight fragility of the wider public support, because the public aren't asked what should be the priorities of research. They're never told what's happening locally. They're not engaged in a dialogue. So I think there's a real task to be done of democratizing R&D. And about a year and a half ago, as part of a global project looking at global science and technology and whether it aligned with the Sustainable Development Goals, and we found it didn't, perhaps not surprisingly. There was very little good alignment of what the world had said were its top priorities and where the world was devoting its brain power, its resources. And if you're interested, it's called Strings, and it has lots of country analyses, etc. But it also showed there was no place in the world system to even have that dialogue, that discussion. We have a World Bank, an IMF, all sorts of global institutions, but none which curate a global conversation about the priorities of science. There's then a whole tradition of trying to involve the public in the difficult, often ethical, decisions which are needed around science. Denmark was the pioneer. These are their consensus conferences, which started in the 80s. There's now quite a few citizens' assemblies and others looking at topics like end-of-life decisions, climate change, and so on, and experimentation in trying to really work out how do we involve the public using deliberative methods in these often very difficult, nuanced decisions. And we will need these around quantum, the questions of privacy and economic growth, which I mentioned earlier. We haven't got there yet. And that will be helped by another trend. How many people in here are on Zoe, interestingly? Couple, yeah. So Zoe is, a really interesting initiative for lots of reasons. Mainly, people use it for self-monitoring. But in the pandemic, they collected symptoms, COVID symptoms. 4 million people signed up to share data on COVID symptoms. And it's a bit controversial, but certainly at some points they had a more accurate picture of new variants than the National Health Service or Department of Health, which annoyed people like Chris Whitty, I think. But this growth of citizen science, let's say of people themselves becoming generators of knowledge, is a key part of the world we're in, and in many ways I think a very, very healthy one, which changes the dynamics of the relationship. There's a very different topic, which I love Nick's views on, which again the science world hates talking about, but is going to at some point become very prominent. This is it's called Eroom's Law. It's the reverse of Moore's Law. Moore's Law, if you remember, says that the capability per cost of digital technologies and semiconductors goes up like that. This is essentially the efficiency of R&D in pharmaceuticals over the last 70 years, a slightly embarrassingly downward sloping curve, as you may notice. And there's been quite a lot of research recently showing this is also happening in many other sectors. Now, usually, if a government sees stagnant or falling productivity in a sector, it thinks something needs to be done, something needs to change. How many people are familiar with this story, that R&D productivity is in decline? So a couple of you are, three or four. It's almost never mentioned in the national media. You have to be very well informed, as you are, to know about it. So it's been quite successfully squeezed out of the debate. But it's a bit of a challenge for the autonomy of science, because it's taking more and more public money to apparently ever less effect. And often it's the biomedical sector is very good at getting its people in the top positions, like Patrick Vallance, partly, I think, to stop this debate happening. And there's then a lot of interesting questions about institutional design. There used to be, in the US Congress, an Office of Technology Assessment to try and think about science and technology and democracy and so on. It was abolished by Newt Gingrich. And I think we in Britain created one of the best ever institutions of science governance, the HFEA, founded more than a generation ago, Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, out of a huge national debate, huge parliamentary debate, one of the biggest ever, on cloning, IVF, all these other things, which then created an institution whose job was not only to regulate the science, but also to explain it to the public, to legitimate decisions, to be very open. And I think they've done a fantastic job over several decades in often allowing quite risky, quite complex scientific experiment, but always at the same time involving the public, explaining it, and the reasoning. For the internet, nothing like that was created. I think historians will think it was insane that no institutions were created to do that kind of deliberation about the internet. On AI, we still don't have a single one doing that. We will have little bits of it fairly soon. There's a whole global side to this I'll jump over. Just two final points. One, I used the play The Enemy of the People by Ibsen, which some of you will be familiar with, which is a play in which this guy discovers basically an infection in the water of a spa. So it's very relevant to Bath. It must be on all the time in Bath, actually, isn't it? And he says, obviously, it needs to be shut down. And then basically everyone, the mayor, the newspaper editor, and the community decide to turn on him because he's going to destroy their livelihood. And this is often presented as a play about the scientist speaking truth to power, the hero scientist. And when it was on in Beijing about 3 or 4 years ago, audiences cheered it, and the government actually had to ban it because it was being interpreted in that way. But I think it's a more interesting play than that. And in Ibsen's mind, he, in fact, is a little bit of a fool. He's clever, but he doesn't see the other dimensions of the question. He doesn't empathize with why people might take a different point of view. So it's a much more subtle play than it's sometimes presented. And to me, this sums up a real issue of science, that it has fantastic methods of analysis, let's say, of infections in spa water, but very, very weak methods of synthesis, of understanding how different kind of knowledges combine. And one of the things I did in the pandemic was look at all the kinds of knowledge a government might be needing to use to make a decision, like on lockdowns or opening the schools, and I won't go through all of these, but you can see at a glance, they're all quite different species of knowledge, from ethics to politics to practitioner views and so on. And you had to synthesize these. But I then did a study interviewing lots of governments around the world, and none of them actually could articulate how they did it. It was sort of vaguely assumed it might happen in the mind of a prime minister. But the idea that Boris Johnson's mind would, in a genius way, synthesize all of these things was not actually very plausible. So there's a missing intellectual piece and a practical piece here around the methods of synthesizing. And it's very important for science because early on, the sort of biomedical knowledge on infections was really crucial for making decisions on the pandemic. But at later stages, knowledge of mental health effects or economic effects, all sorts of other things, also became important, and arguably more important than that. So the ability to navigate and synthesize multiple kinds of knowledge and know which ones are most important for what task is, to my mind, the metacognition task needed at the heart of any government and potentially at the heart of any university. And so this takes me to a little sort of side discussion on skills. If you want a laugh, Jon Stewart on The Daily Show in the US quite often has little clips of people like the chair of the House Scientific Committee. I don't know if you've seen that, it's a few weeks ago. And the basic joke is these people know nothing about science. He hasn't even got 10-year-old science, and he embarrasses himself talking about ice melting and things like that. But there's a glaring skills gap, especially for politicians, but also for civil servants, where they're often trained in law and economics, but have only a very tenuous grasp of the sort of issues I've been talking about. Some places around the world do quite systematic teaching, the China Leadership Academy, where ministers have to do 2 weeks residential courses a year. Bloomberg's done some for mayors. A new one in Australia has a very good curriculum for politicians, but we have nothing like that in Britain. And so our politicians may have a couple of little seminars on how to talk to a private secretary, but they will be thrown into these hugely powerful roles, navigating very complex science with almost no preparation at all, which I think is a little bit of a problem. So, in summary, and in a way this is maybe the blindingly obvious sort of core of this book, I've realised, is science is incredibly powerful sort of telling us about the world, the facts of the world, about light or energy or disease. But it can't tell us what matters or what's important. Politics ultimately is the way we collectively decide what matters. And we need institutions, processes, and capabilities which allow us to weave the two together. The understanding of what is the best available science, but also the best available capacity to think about what matters. And in a way, I think that leads to a different story about both the autonomy of science and the complete sovereignty of democracy. And I argue, and this probably is controversial, it's definitely controversial, that actually to claim absolute sovereignty for democracy, I don't think makes much sense anymore. I think there's also a claim to sovereignty of collective knowledge, of the wisdom accumulated by the world over centuries or millennium, which will sometimes clash with democracy and also, I think, has a claim, though, on decisions. But equally, this ideal of pure autonomy and detachment of science makes no sense when so much of democracy and politics is infused with the requirement to understand the science. And so, in a sense, that's the agenda I'm trying to open up, is how do we actually, you know, do this, design the new institutions, the new processes, put in place the new capabilities ahead of the next set of challenges, whether they're pandemics, worsening climate change, and, you know, farmer backlashes against climate action, or AI and quantum. So I'll stop there. I hope that's at least got someone got a question to ask. Thank you.